Good morning, Chief Justice Steele. May it please the Court, William Fletcher on behalf of the appellant, Michelle Reed. This appeal involves two issues dealing with a party's right to trial by jury. The first issue deals with whether a post-trial motion by a defendant seeking additor, which is granted by the trial court without the consent of the plaintiff, violates the plaintiff's right to trial by jury. The second question is whether or not on the record that exists regarding defendant Daisy Construction Company, was there material issues of fact regarding that record which would permit a jury, which would require the jury to resolve those issues on the plaintiff's claim of negligence against defendant Daisy. This matter arose out of a motor vehicle collision that occurred on November 5th of 1999 on U.S. Route 13 at Woodside, Delaware. That is a major intersection controlled by traffic lights, and it involves a multiple car collision that occurred approximately 0.2 miles north of the intersection. A Daisy Construction Company at the time was controlling this area because it had shut down the right lane of northbound 13 and was funneling traffic into the left through lane of northbound 13. The matter went to trial once in September of 2005, and a jury verdict of zero damages was rendered in favor of the plaintiff. A motion for a new trial was granted, and a second trial was held in November of 2007, and a second verdict of zero damages was rendered for the plaintiff.
The basis for granting the new trial the first time was that there was uncontradicted evidence of injury, of compensable injury.
Yes, sir.
And therefore, for the jury to award zero damages was against the weight of the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. The second time around, we had the same result. Was there also uncontradicted evidence, or was there evidence to the contrary, introduced by the defense side, different from what was done the first time around?
No, Your Honor. There was still the very same. In fact, there was even more uncontroverted evidence of injury because two additional treating doctors were called by the plaintiff in the second trial, in addition to the one doctor that testified in both.
Okay, but from the defense side, though, there was no difference in the record.
That's exactly, yes, Your Honor. They brought no doctor forward. Although they had the plaintiff examined, they offered no medical evidence.
Okay, one last question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I assume that that counsel for the defendant argued that there was no damage, that is, no compensable harm, and the jury should award a zero verdict, and that trial counsel for the plaintiff knew that that argument was going to be made, correct?
Your Honor, that was not a clear-cut issue in the case. The defense seemed to state
Here's the reason why I asked the question. Wouldn't it have been appropriate, particularly given the history of the case, for plaintiff's counsel to request the judge to instruct the jury that it had to award some damage and that it wasn't free to find zero damages?
Your Honor, I think I could have requested that instruction. Yes, Your Honor. I don't know if the court would have given it. I have read in some of the cases that there's an indication that that's within the discretion of the judge as to whether or not that type
of. But there wasn't any such instruction requested, and so we once again have a zero verdict for the plaintiff and a request for a third trial. And based on your position, one of your positions, which is that there shouldn't have been additor at all, that we could have an infinite repetition of this series of events until finally some jury decided to award damages. Is that your position?
Your Honor, I understand, given the fact that there were two trials, We don't contend that there's an infinite number of trials that lie ahead. And perhaps at a third trial, that type of instruction would be given by the request of perhaps both parties. There may even be a stipulation entered that there were damages incurred, and so an award must be entered. But there are also, of course, Your Honor, other methods for the court to consider before the matter even goes to a third trial, including alternative dispute resolution possibilities, whether it involved the trial judge or a third party. That has not been attempted.
But that's a practical argument. We're arguing what the law is here, or should be.
Yes, Your Honor, we are. And in arguing what the law is, the problem is the plaintiff has yet to have the right to have a fair and impartial jury act on the evidence. Twice they've rejected the evidence.
Isn't that going a little far? That was true the first time, or at least Judge Vaughn agreed with you. But the second time, if your client was deprived of the right to have a jury fairly evaluate the evidence, it's because the jury wasn't instructed on how to evaluate the evidence, and you didn't ask the judge to instruct the jury that way.
Your Honor, I did not ask, and neither did the defense, and the defense did not admit in either their opening or closing that there was an entitlement to an award. The defense was very ambiguous as to their argument as to what the nature and extent of the injuries were.
I missed the part in your brief about why the jury wasn't fair and impartial. Why wasn't the jury fair and impartial? I understand you disagree with their award, but what are the allegations in the record to support your statement that they weren't fair and impartial?
Your Honor, relying upon this court's holding in Amalfitano versus Baker, there was undisputed, unrefuted, objective findings of injury given by the medical testimony of the medical doctor.
I understand that. But tell me why the jury was composed in an unfair way, or tell me why a member of the jury was not impartial.
Because, Your Honor, they refused to act upon that unrebutted, unrefuted evidence and award damages.
Well, couldn't the reason why that happened be that they didn't understand the technical concept that you have to award minimal damages, even if you don't believe that the injury deserved any real compensation? You have to give an award of $10 or $100 or $50, that in their common sense analysis of the facts that were presented, they came to a conclusion, a second jury came to the same conclusion, that the nature of these damages, although we heard the evidence and we believe it and it's uncontradicted, we think it doesn't rise to the level of warranting a payment for what we consider to be de minimis injury. Why is that not the logical inference to draw from the fact that two juries in a row, none of them having any other apparent problems, no apparent difficulty with the way the trial proceeded, and both juries come back with a zero verdict?
Your Honor, I don't think it would be appropriate to suggest to the jury, whether it be in an instruction by the court or in argument by counsel, as to an amount that should be awarded, even though it might be considered a minimal amount. I don't believe.
No, but that's not really what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is the fact that you're saying this jury didn't do its job because there was undisputed evidence of an injury and they came back zero. And what I'm trying to get at is that this jury wasn't told that, you know, because there's undisputed evidence of injury, you have to give something. It can be minimal, it can be anything you want that you think is appropriate, but you have to give them something. They weren't told that, so instead they acted in their own common sense, which was, this is so small that we'll go with zero. They didn't realize that there was a problem with zero that wouldn't be a problem if they had said $10. So why should we interpret this situation any differently than just saying that's what the jury did? They weren't instructed that they had to put a dollar amount on it. They put a zero on it, and that's the end of it.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that that might very well be a practical approach to dealing with some of these zero verdicts that the court's well aware of have been rendered in this state in the last few years on a more than irregular basis. The problem is, Your Honor, there certainly was no precedent requiring or instructing the lower court to do that at the time that this case was tried. And that may very well be something that the court wishes to address.
Well, if Amalfitano was the law, wasn't it the law in 2007?
Amalfitano was the law, yes, Your Honor.
And what does Amalfitano say?
Your Honor, it holds that if there is objective, unrebutted medical evidence of injury, then the plaintiff is entitled to a new trial if the jury awards a verdict of zero damages. That is a verdict that is improper and cannot stand.
Well, under those circumstances, the circumstances that you've described, unrebutted evidence, uncontradicted evidence of injury, why wouldn't the law of the case be that the trial judge should instruct the jury that that is the law and therefore they must find damages, must award damages in at least some amount? Why wouldn't that be the appropriate instruction?
Your Honor, that may very well be an appropriate instruction.
How do we factor two other things into this case? As I understand it, some out-of-pocket expenses and medical bills were paid, and the jury was instructed that those had been paid. Is that correct?
Your Honor, they were instructed that a standard if this is what Your Honor is referring to, a standard instruction, a pattern instruction of regarding payment of medical expenses by PIP coverage?
Right.
Yes, that instruction was given.
So the jury knew, at least to that extent, your client had received some money for those expenses?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then and the record seems to suggest, and it was certainly argued by your opponent, that there might have been questions about how forthcoming your client was with regard to pre-existing injuries.
Your Honor, I don't think that there were pre-existing
Other injuries.
Other injuries.
So if the jury knew your client got some money and the jury was concerned about your client's credibility, hypothetically, we'll assume the facts supported that, why wouldn't they be entitled to come back with a zero verdict?
Your Honor, the reason that instruction was given on the no-fault benefits is because there were medical expenses admitted into evidence after the no-fault period in excess of $7,500. Those expenses begin on a date that is more than 2 years after the accident, and the jury would see that. So to avoid confusion, it could possibly look like, well, the first time this lady's having treatment is 2 years after the accident, it's explained that any medical expenses in the first 2 years was already paid. But there was no doctor to dispute that the evidence of record, the $7,500, was not necessary and appropriate.
So going back to the earlier questions, you would submit at a minimum and the jury had to award $7,500.
Yes, Your Honor. And I guess maybe just to briefly address, there was no doctor's opinion that any other incident caused this lady injury in a permanent fashion. In other words, there was no doctor who said something that happened 3 months after the accident is what caused her injury. The doctors that testified said it was the automobile accident, a very severe automobile accident, Your Honor. And I certainly recognize that there are many cases where even though the court has rules on this, the nature of the impact, the type of damage involved, indicate to common lay people that there must not be much injury. This was a three-car accident, Your Honor. There was a rear-end collision. a second collision occurred that turned my client's car 180 degrees, and then there was yet another impact.
Yeah, these cars Mr. Fletcher, there still was a dispute at the trial and on the record as to what type of physical injuries, if any, your client suffered as a consequence of the collision that you just described to us. Isn't the reason that the court, when doing an additor, didn't award the full $7,500, wasn't the reason that the court found, although without explanation, that that it wasn't persuaded that $7,500 worth of medical, that is, the treatment for $7,500 worth of medical injury was required as a consequence of this accident?
Your Honor, that is what without explanation, that is what one would arrive at from reading the judge's opinion. But that ignores the fact, Your Honor, that it was unrebutted that from the date of the accident until November of the following year, 2001, Dr. Duchotel had treated this woman, and he had prepared a report in November of 2001 saying that she had a permanent injury to her cervical region. The second accident happened the following month, in December of 2001, and the doctor that treated her for that indicated that that was of a transitory nature. But you already had a doctor with no other accidents involved giving this woman a permanent impairment from this accident of 1999. And the lower court seemed not to give that much consideration, but there was no medical reason not to.
But I don't understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're arguing in your brief that the non-award of the full $7,500 was error. Your argument is that there shouldn't have been any additor at all, that the case should have gone to a third trial.
Your Honor, to a certain extent, Your Honor, I would just add one thing to that.
Well, is the answer a yes?
Then the answer would be no, Your Honor, because our argument is we should have, as the plaintiff and the non-moving party, we should have been given the opportunity to consider additor, which we were not. However, we put on the record that a $2,500 additor we would have rejected. So, yes, we wanted a third trial. But what part of the error that we raised in this case is that the plaintiff was never permitted to participate in the additor process. It was the defendant moved for it, the court granted it, and the court said it's up to the defendant to accept it. The plaintiff was never asked anything.
Isn't that consistent with Justice Stone's consent in the Dimmock case, as adopted by Judge Pullen in later cases in the Superior Court? Specifically, what I'm talking about is, and the focus is, that this is a legal determination, and where the court is determining the range of the verdict, and the consent is obtained from the party resisting the motion for the new trial, not the party asking.
You know, Your Honor, I would disagree with that to some extent. I would certainly agree that the dissent in the United States Supreme Court case said that they would have allowed additor, although the rule of the day was that additor was totally abolished by the United States Supreme Court because the plaintiff was not a participating a party in the process that occurred in the Dimmock case. And I would also just respond, Your Honor, that Judge Quillen's analysis in both the Carney case and the Hall case are, again, cases where the plaintiff moved affirmatively for additor. And that is not this case, Your Honor. We never asked for additor. It was imposed upon the plaintiff in this case. And it's that imposition by the court without participation that we contend infringes the right to trial by jury.
But that focus is one that these are factual questions as opposed to a legal determination. Is that right?
I'm sorry, what are factual questions?
That depends on whether these are factual questions as opposed to a legal determination of the outer bounds of the verdict, whether it's too little or too much.
Certainly the foundation for our appeal to both the lower court and this court is that the jury verdict was inadequate based upon the Amalfitano case.
And that's a legal determination.
It is, Your Honor. Yes, the lower court determined that that in both cases, the lower court said a zero verdict is inappropriate under the facts of this case. But in the second, after the second trial, the court went on to say that defendant had moved for additor, and therefore I'm going to award additor, and did so.
Let me make sure I understand your argument about additor. It's because you didn't have an opportunity to participate in the process you argue that you were deprived of your right to a jury trial, the additor process. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
What if you had an opportunity to address the defendant's motion for additor, for lack of a better phrase, and simply not prevailed? Would that have been a waiver by you, or would that still be a violation of your right to a jury trial?
The participation that I'm speaking of, Your Honor, is the participation where the party who does not move for additor is presented the proposition, and they have the choice: accept the additor that the court has deemed appropriate, or get a new trial. And those are that's the choice that the non-moving party should have. That's our position, Your Honor. In this case, our choice would have been to not accept the additor and seek a new trial.
So go ahead.
Well, stated another way, it seems you're suggesting the editor should have been available to both parties, and in an absence of both parties agreeing, you got a new trial, because as I understand your position, the court awarded you a new trial, and the defendant unilaterally took your new trial away from you by making a motion for editor and then accepting it, and that's what affected your client's rights, that you're precluded from having this third trial through circumstances beyond your control that you had no input in.
That's correct, Your Honor. We were entitled to a new trial, but then the defendant's motion for additor was granted, and the defendant was the only one who could make the choice, and they chose to take it.
And that in the normal course of events where the plaintiff makes the motion for additor or the defendant moves for remittitor, we know there's going to be a new trial, but it's totally in control of the plaintiff. The plaintiff either accepts the reduction and is happy, or the plaintiff accepts the addition and is happy. But in this particular case, your concern is the plaintiff had no say at all.
That's correct, Your Honor. Although I would just say, and I don't want to get too far afield unless the court wishes to, we don't have a remittiture case here, but...
No, I know. I'm talking about the way they operate.
Yes.
That if the plaintiff gets a new trial, it's normally, I'm going to give the defendant a new trial unless the plaintiff accepts remittiture. But
yes,
the plaintiff has a say.
Yeah.
And then you say, I'm going to give the plaintiff a new trial unless the editor's accepted. But to the extent the editor's accepted by the defendant, it was on the plaintiff's motion.
Yes.
And so here the plaintiff never made a motion and never had any input. So what your argument is, the judge said I was entitled to a new trial, and the defendant's unilateral conduct took that right away from my client.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you want to save your last minute?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, good morning. Excuse me. There should be no dispute that additor and remittitor are two sides of the same coin. They are the constitutionally and legally indistinguishable converse of one another. In both cases, the trial judge makes a post-trial determination after a new trial motion has been filed that the verdict of the jury is inconsistent with the evidence presented. But rather than ignoring the consensus of the people altogether, the judge alters the verdict as minimally as possible to bring it in line with the evidence. Again, while providing all due respect to and preserving the sanctity of the will of the jury. And thus we have the longstanding standard for additor or remittor, that you give the non-moving party, the party opposing the new trial, the non-moving party, every factual inference that the record supports and determine, in the case of additor, the minimal amount that the record justifies. Both tools have been used by the Superior Court for years, for over 70 years at least. This court has sanctioned the use of additor or remittor, and particularly in light of Judge Quillen's decision and logic in the Carney v. Preston case, the issue of the constitutionality of additor or remittor seems settled. And I don't think that the plaintiff takes issue with the actual mechanism itself as a tool of the trial court. Rather, the focus here is on the as Mr. Fletcher said, the additor being imposed upon the plaintiff since the plaintiff had no say, which raises two points. First, in every case of additor or remittor, save one, which I believe is the exception to the rule, not the exception which makes the rule, the Sullivan case, in every other case, in the legion of cases, the party opposing the new trial motion gets the vote, accept this alteration of the jury verdict, or you get a new trial. In every case, which means that in remittor cases, the plaintiff always gets the decision. We're going to reduce this award if you'll take that, or try it again. In every case of additor, no matter who requests it, in every case of additor...
Well, before you get, no matter who requests it, can you cite a case where the defendant made the motion for additor?
I cannot, Your Honor.
And the reason I simply interrupt you there is because normally the plaintiff is saying, I want more money. And what the judge is saying to the defendant is, I'm going to give the plaintiff this additional money or a new trial. And it's the defendant who decides whether or not to pay the additional money. But the request for the additional money comes from the plaintiff. So I understand what you're saying about the constitutionality of editor and remittor, but it does seem to change the procedural posture of the case when the motion's made by the defendant.
The distinction, Your Honor, is, and what alters that point completely, is that the courts, and sanctioned again by this court, have on many occasions, on several occasions, granted or awarded or ordered additor or remittor sua sponte. So if the court can do it without prompting, can do it sua sponte, then who the requesting party is really irrelevant. Because in that case, the court is imposing on the plaintiff, take this money if the defendant agrees or take a new trial. So the notion that the plaintiff has to control it is simply misguided. In several cases, and the supplemental case that I provided to the court after the initial argument, the Kempler v. Alexander case, was a remittor case, again, interchangeable. And in that case, the Supreme Court, Justice Moore, said that it is, although parties generally request a remittor as an alternate to requesting a new trial, a trial court may grant a remittor on its own initiative where a party has filed a motion for a new trial on the ground that the jury award was, in that case, excessive. So if the court can do it sua sponte, this notion that somebody is out there imposing additor on a plaintiff has no merit, because...
Let's assume, just to simplify the analysis here, that the court had decided to award additor sua sponte. What does the case law tell us as to the process by which that occurs? That is, can the court just take a number out of the air? Is there any right to be heard on the part of the plaintiff in those circumstances?
Your Honor, the standard remains the same. The court is instructed to give, to take the record in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, the party opposing the new trial, and determine an award which the record minimally justifies in the case of additor, or maximally in the case of remittor. So the standard doesn't change. The court, as it has done, again, repeatedly, back in 1938 in Rudnick v. Jacobs.
Is the court required to give the parties And in this case, the plaintiff, who would be adversely affected, maybe the defendant too, the right to be heard on the amount of additor.
No, Your Honor, I'm sorry. The answer is no. The court, everybody has heard all of the evidence. In every one of these cases, sua sponte or not, even when the plaintiff requests additor, the court never has another hearing. The court makes a determination. Again, the standard is, given the record that's been presented for additor, what is the minimal amount that the evidence requires to conform with the evidence? So that's the standard in every case, no matter who requests it.
Mr. Young, here's the problem I'm having. I understand your point about remittiture and additor being opposite sides of the same coin. But for an additor to be awarded after the trial judge has said to the plaintiff, you're entitled to a new trial, and then the defendant asks for additor, the plaintiff hasn't waived its right to a new trial, which you can argue if it were the plaintiff asking for additor. That's a concession on the plaintiff's part that I'll accept additor or a new trial. But I've never run into the circumstance where the plaintiff has been granted, in effect, or is entitled to a new trial, and then the defense asks for additor, and it's as if the plaintiff isn't in the room. The plaintiff either accepts the additor or not, and if the plaintiff says, I don't accept it, isn't the plaintiff then entitled to a new trial?
And, Your Honor, again, my point is that there is no distinction from that scenario than a sua sponte award of additor, which, again, this court has sanctioned. There is no legal distinction between what happened in the Kemple v. Alexander case.
But the court can't award additor and say, now you don't get your new trial that you're entitled to because I've decided additor is the way to resolve this case.
Sure. The court did that in Kemple v. Alexander, except on the remittiture end. The court said, here's what you're going to take, Mr. Defendant, if the plaintiff accepts it. And I know you didn't ask for it, and maybe you don't want it, but I'm imposing it on you, sua sponte. And the plaintiff gets the choice. That's exactly what happened in Kemple.
How can you say it was being imposed? Because if the defendant said, I'm not paying,
then it
would have been
a new trial.
Sure.
And the converse is true here.
Well, except that the plaintiff is saying, I don't want the money. I want a new trial.
Well, because the plaintiff doesn't get to choose when it's the moving party for a new trial. Right. The defense.
Let me ask you something. You did not cross appeal the ruling on the new trial.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So to the extent the new trial was granted after, motion was granted after the first trial, and now the new trial motion is granted after the second trial, we can assume that the record supports the judge's decision, at least because it's not an issue on this appeal because there's been no cross appeal.
It has not been cross appeal. That's correct, Your
Honor. So then the only question here is whether the judge could subsequently take away the decision to award a new trial through this additor procedure.
That's correct, just as this court sanctioned in Kemple on the remittiture side. I would say that there is no any distinction between Kemple and this case is a distinction without a difference. It's just the converse, the exact same, where the side that moved for a new trial does not get to pick whether to have the altered verdict or the new trial. The opposing party does. The party opposing the new trial is the non-moving party. It doesn't matter who puts the word additor in his or her brief. That's completely irrelevant. That misplaces the focus. The focus should be on who says this jury didn't get it right, or in this case didn't get it right a second time. And the party opposing that is the non-moving party to whom the evidentiary basis and favor goes when determining the additor amount.
Can I interrupt you?
Sure.
Your analysis works fine, I guess, in terms of who's the moving party, who's the non-moving party. Can you tell me another case where the defendant moved for additor?
I cannot, Your Honor.
And doesn't that kind of highlight what the problem is here? that you know, when you talk about moving party, non-moving party, there's kind of an underlying assumption that the moving party on remittiture is going to be the defendant, and the moving party on additor is going to be the plaintiff, and so the other aspects of it are in alignment. And what we have here is what we might call the anomaly of the defendant saying, please, judge, award more money. And now you're making the argument that, well, because we were the moving party, we get the choice. But don't you have to factor into this analysis the what's really going on here, which is that you don't want a new trial, and the party that does want a new trial has been taken out of the equation.
This is an anomaly, Your Honor. There's no question. I did find a case where there was a plaintiff's verdict where the plaintiff's lawyer suggested remittiture. That never got up here. But I know I think there's probably the only two cases on those two sides of things. But it's an anomaly that is irrelevant because it takes the focus off of the fact that in every additor case, the defendant gets the choice because the defendant is the non-moving party. The defendant wants to preserve what the will of the people has been, in this case twice.
And when you refer to the moving party, you're referring to the non-moving party because that's not the party who moved for a new trial. You're not talking about the party who moved for additor.
That's correct, Your Honor, because really there is no – you don't have to move for additor. The court can do it sua sponte. So
the court
moving
didn't do it sua sponte
well,
here.
I suspect Judge Vaughn would have done that without me mentioning the word additor. Because of what happened in the first trial, I included it. But it's a tool of the court.
Or he could have said, if this is going to be tried a third time, I'm assigning it to someone else.
A distinct possibility.
So are you saying that if the judge had done it sua sponte, if the judge said, I'm granting a new trial or additor in the amount of $2,500, if the judge had said that sua sponte, your position is that the plaintiff would have been bound to accept the $2,500 and could not have said, no, I want the new trial, not the $2,500.
It would have been the defendant's choice, as it always is, Your Honor, always.
I understand the defendant's choice.
So if the defendant had said, I'll accept the $2,500, the plaintiff has no alternative. That's correct.
Well, doesn't the plaintiff have the ability to argue it's an error of law, that is not the lower limit on the evidence in this case?
Sure, that issue, the issue on the amount alone could have come up, but the issue of whether or not the defense had the choice, I don't think could have come up.
But how could the issue of the amount have come up if there was no right on the plaintiff's part to be heard, you know, once it was determined that there would be an additor?
It certainly would be my position, Justice Jacobs, that it should not have come up. But I think that from a legal perspective, as with a zero verdict eventually coming up, the plaintiff could have argued, well, you ordered $2,500 sua sponte. The defendant got the choice, as the defendant always does in an additor situation. But that number by the court was a legal error based on XYZ evidence, and we could have come up here and argued about whether the record supported $2,500 as a minimum verdict.
So your position is, going back to the sua sponte type of case, in that if the judge has said, I'm awarding the plaintiff a new trial unless the defendant accepts additor in the amount of $2,500, and then you would come in and say, we accept the $2,500, we'd be right where we are in this case.
No, Your Honor, I don't know what Mr. Fletcher would have done, but I think the record is replete with support for $2,500 as a verdict. And
I'm not talking about the amount of money. I'm talking about your suggestion that these are mirror image things. What we see here is really no different than what would have happened if the judge had done it sua sponte. I just want to understand your characterization of what would have happened if the judge did it sua sponte. And as I understand it, if there was a motion for a new trial by Mr. Fletcher, the judge would have written an opinion, and the opinion would have said, Mr. Fletcher, I grant your client a new trial, and then sua sponte said, however, I'm awarding editor in the amount of $2,500. And if the defendant accepts the $2,500, then there's not going to be a new trial.
Then that's where this case ends, Your Honor, because then it's identical to this White v. State Farm case where Justice Ridgely, I think it was his last trial before he came up on the Supreme Court, and Junginger v. Betts. That's exactly what happened in those cases. They just didn't get appealed. Unless there are any other questions by the court, I'm finished with my presentation.
Do you have any comment on the award of zero damages?
Sure, Your Honor. And I realize that there's been some discussion about the lack of fleshing out that number. It seems to me that paragraph 4 in President Judge Vaughn's decision is sufficient. Again, this is a trial court writing to two lawyers who've been through this on two occasions, which may not be the best approach for appeal purposes, but I think that sets forth sufficient basis for the $2,500. Further basis for that is in my statement of facts, which I, of course, won't repeat to all of you. But this is a case where a plaintiff who had significant credibility problems, who had a fall very shortly after the accident with injuries, who had two motor vehicle accidents afterward, ended up with a case where, again, given the standard for additor, was in a position where 2 months of a strain or sprain case with very few, if any, objective findings, $2,500 is more than adequate for that kind of case. If the jury had come back at $2,500, there's certainly no question that anyone would have it would have stood up without.
Do you agree that when the jury comes back with zero damages on those facts, given the state of the law, that the plaintiff would be entitled to a new trial?
I would not agree with that, Your Honor. It seems to me that the only objective finding, and again, we have a soft tissue case with significant credibility problems for the plaintiff, which is the critical issue in a soft tissue case, probably in any personal injury case. The only objective finding was a note in Dr. Duchettle's record of spasm at one point. Because of rulings that guide the Superior Court now, that may be sufficient to negate a zero verdict. Obviously, I can't take issue with this court's finding, but I think that under these circumstances, and I've heard doctors say spasm doesn't necessarily mean anything, and since that was the only objective finding in a strictly subjective case with major credit.
You didn't call a physician that said spasm doesn't necessarily mean anything.
I did not, Your Honor. You asked me my thoughts, and my thought is that one spasm does not equal money necessarily.
All right. I apologize for asking you. Anything further?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, and Justice Ridgely. I represent Daisy Construction Company on this appeal. There is no issue of material fact which would warrant a reversal and a remand of Judge Vaughn's decision granting summary judgment in favor of Daisy Construction back in August of 2005. It's been quite some time since my client has been an active participant in this case. The case involves, as you know, a three-car rear-end collision. The undisputed facts are that the vehicle in front of the plaintiff's vehicle was able to come to a stop regardless of what was happening ahead of it in terms of the construction or the road improvements being performed. It was not hindered in any way. The first vehicle was not hindered in any way by the construction and road improvements being conducted by my client, Daisy Construction, and in fact was stopped for several minutes, according to that driver's testimony, Mr. Mayer, before the collision occurred with the plaintiff's vehicle. The plaintiff was able also to come to a stop behind Mr. Mayer's vehicle, and what the important facts about that are that the plaintiff saw a flagger, saw warning signs or signs alerting drivers to the road construction ahead before she saw the flagger, saw that the traffic was being diverted from the right lane to the left lane, and was able to come to a stop behind the vehicle in front of her without hitting that vehicle. The evidence is that the defendant's vehicle, Ms. Hint, was traveling behind the plaintiff's vehicle. There was another vehicle in between them, a large SUV, and Ms. Hint admittedly was negligent and was inattentive to the road conditions ahead of her. She was unable to stop and avoid a collision with the plaintiff's vehicle after the SUV she was following had moved or veered to the left to go around the traffic that was stopped. Ms. Hint hit the plaintiff's vehicle in the rear, and in all of her testimony and written discovery, she has admitted negligence and inattentiveness in causing the accident. So to the extent that the plaintiff argues that there are issues of fact relating to the number of flaggers that were on the scene or the length of the cones that were tapering the closure of the right lane so that traffic could go into the left lane, even if those facts are in dispute, they are not material to the outcome of the case. As Judge Vaughn pointed out, the event which caused traffic to stop is unexplained and not relevant to the outcome. Whether there were fewer than two flaggers, whether there was a shortened taper of cones, this accident would have happened in the fashion it happened simply because Ms. Hint, who caused the accident, was inattentive. She had no idea what was ahead of her. There could have been five flaggers up ahead. Traffic could have been stopping for any number of reasons, for road construction, for congestion, for debris in the road. It wouldn't have mattered in the outcome of this case. And even if, again, we accept the disputed facts as argued by the plaintiff, those facts in and of themselves don't advance the arguments. They're deficient in some respects. For instance, in support of the argument that there was a shorter taper of cones in the right lane than there should have been, the plaintiff relies upon an unverified police report. The sworn testimony of the police officer is not in the record. The police report put into evidence in opposition to Daisy's motion for summary judgment was not put in by affidavit as required under Rule 56. So it's an unsupported police report. We know it's conceded by the plaintiff. It's not to scale. It wasn't meant to be an accurate depiction of the actual number of cones or the location of the cones at the accident scene. So that doesn't really create an issue of fact. That document in and of itself being unverified would not create an issue of fact as to whether or not there were sufficient cones. With regard to the number of flaggers, again, that does not affect the outcome in this case. The plaintiff has testified she saw a flagger. She followed the road construction signs. In her arbitration testimony, she couldn't remember whether or not she was aware of the cones being in the right lane to taper it off. However, when she testified at one of her trials, she clearly indicated that she saw the cones tapering the road. And more than that, she said that traffic was slowly moving from the right lane to the left lane. And that testimony is in the record at page A280. And that conflicts with her, to some extent, with the arguments she's raised in her appeal and is different than what she testified to at her arbitration at A32 regarding not being aware of whether or not she even saw the cones.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Regarding the Daisy Construction Company dismissal by the lower court, we basically contend that Daisy, through Mr. Anderson, their supervisor, said that this work project required two flaggers, one at the Woodside intersection and one with the machinery that was up ahead. This was a moving operation. They were lining the roadway, and so the equipment would move down the road. They did not have two flaggers. There was no flagger with the equipment. And Mr. Maurer, the witness, said the reason that traffic was being stopped was they were trying to move equipment off of or through the left lane that was the open lane. And there was no communication to the flagger at Woodside that this was going to happen because there wasn't a flagger to tell the person at Woodside. And so the person at Woodside, the one and only flagger, was flagging traffic on to keep moving up the roadway when there was a stoppage up the roadway because of the construction equipment.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.